Good morning, everyone. Good. How did they form? Right? So they're there, massive black holes, much more massive than we thought they were, at least from the black holes that we saw in our own galaxy, at least somewhere around 30 solar masses. We have seen things up to about 10-ish, some error bars above that, but they're questionable whether they're real. So how did they form? So there's two talks this morning. One is discussing formation channels where dynamics plays a role, and this is the formation channel where dynamics is not playing a role, which we call the field binders, but they could be anywhere. So I'm going to leave it a little bit at a qualitative conceptual level, but there's a lot of things we should discuss in detail over this week, but it's more to inspire the themes of the discussion. So this is just to set the scene. Oh, that's going to kill my presentation. So also myself are trying to get a feeling for different timescales and what are we working with if these things form. So actually I come more from working on massive stars when they're still alive. That would be T0, somewhere in the history of our universe. And then pretty quickly after, a few million years, that's quick after, we would have two black holes, at least in the scenarios that I propose. And then for a long time, nothing happens except for a bit of very slow gravitational wave radiation slowly bringing these two together and merging. And that would be giga years later, probably. There's some channels that would put it as a very prompt channel, but I think most of the channels, it takes giga years for them to merge. So even though the merger happened at not that high redshift, the formation could be redshift 2, 3, a bit more. Probably not too high, unless you're a fan of population 3 stars, then it's probably pretty high redshift. But there's not much mass in pop 3 stars. So I'm going to talk about things that are not pop 3 stars. So this would happen somewhere close to the peak of star formation with the right composition. So that is maybe redshift 2, 3, 4-ish. Not too much further. And so the two talks this morning, they tried to divide the formation channels by this particular parameter. What is the stellar density where these things happen? And so I will be discussing, call them isolated binaries, which is a bit of a funny way to say it. We barely see massive stars being isolated, unless they may be runaway stars or something. They're always in some sort of clusters or associations. The only thing I'm saying is that the dynamics is not playing a major role in the formation channel. And on the other side, we have very dense stellar systems. Think of dense star clusters or galactic nuclei, where actually the way to bring these black holes together is dominated by dynamical effects. And so we could call these the evolutionary channels, dynamical channels. And so it's already dangerous to draw this divide. It's more a divide of what people were trained in when they started in this field. So on this area, we have the people that came from stellar evolution and maybe moved into binaries. Think about they really solved the stellar structure equations. People using MESA or many of the progenitor codes. So that's the people on this side. And so on this side, there is a large crowd that comes from having fun in solving n-body problems. And so these communities move together. So on this side, of course, stars evolve, and there's a lot of stellar physics happening. But if you want to solve n-body systems, you probably have to simplify how much time you spend on the stellar evolution. So a lot of the stellar evolution in this part is simplified. Here as well, of course, stars are complicated beasts, but at least done a bit more detail. So one of the themes of my talk is also that if we look in a bit more detail in these processes, we actually find new channels that we haven't expected yet, if you do this in a bit more detail. And so so these things, the expertises of these groups overlap and move back and forward, and of course we have things in between. I think the triples would be interesting to place in the middle of this group here. And so the two things I will discuss is the classic channel and a new channel. I'll tell more later. The classic channel has been there for a while, going back to the 70s in the chemically homogeneous channel. I'll be a bit biased there. You see my name there. That's so there will be a bit biased there, and Pablo Marchand will also talk about that. But before we do that, let's stay a bit more general, and I want to point out two challenges or two objectives that these formation channels have. Before it was predictions, now it's post-dictions, right? Now we have objectives, what we need to reach. So there are many constraints, but I want to focus on two things. How do we get them close, and how do we get them massive? So simplifying things. So close, how close do we need them? So in the channels I'm thinking about, the stars will be born, quickly form black holes, and then there's a long time for them to emit gravitational waves and shrink. But it's not a super efficient process, so already at this stage, we need two black holes in a pretty close orbit. How close? Now let's look at the timescales. So if I just look at the gravitational wave radiation time scale, so this will be the separation of the binary and the mass of the primary black hole. I can plot contours how long it takes for these things to coalesce. And so I already chose the axis range as such that you are sort of between 0.1 and 10 giga year in this plot. So if you want a system to merge within a Hubble time, and one of the components about 30 solar masses, so these are contours, so the full lines are for equal mass binaries and the dotted line are mass ratio of half. If you want a 30 solar mass primary black hole to merge within a Hubble time, it has to be roughly 10 solar radii apart. Apology for the physicists, it's nice to work in solar radii because we get a visual perception of what the system would be like, right? But if you prefer other units, it's fine. But roughly 10 solar radii is the separation where we need to put them. So that's the first challenge. How can you do that? So it's not such a big challenge, it seems, because we see a lot of binaries alive with stars in them that are at such separations. But it's, to put it in this perspective, 10 times the radius of the sun. A massive star is already a few times the radius of the sun when it's born. And so 10 solar radius mean if it would be at birth that way, this is roughly the scale of the system. Not exactly, but this would be the size of a star at birth, and this would be roughly the 10 solar radii. I just dropped them there. And so that's a problem because stars get big. Most stars get big. Stars at least swell up by a factor 100 or so in size. There's uncertainties there. But so this is what should be happening. And so you see this challenge to, if they're born this way, something needs to happen, right? And so this brings me directly to the second question, or the second challenge for these systems. If they're so close, this star will tidally strip a lot of material from this star, for Worslop overflow, common envelope, so you can eject a lot of mass if you would start this way. And if you didn't, then they'd probably merge now, and that's not what we want. We would like them first to make black holes and then merge, not before, right? So, these stars have these sizes before they're born as well. So my only justification to start with this picture is that we have a snapshot of stars at the moment they start hydrogen burning our compact. That's the moment they're pretty long-lived and where we have data and where we know they are in certain separation distribution, which I'll show in a moment. But Elliot is... We have all confidence they do because we see them out there. Good luck to the theorists to explain why. But okay, different to talk, so I'm gonna, sorry. It is very relevant because maybe some of the physics that plays a role there will play a role again, of course. But I'm simplifying things more. So it brings me to the mass challenge. Okay, we can put them close together, but you will strip up a lot of mass or do other things that will prevent them from merging. So how can we, these are two things that are sort of mutually exclusive in these channels. How do we put them both close, but still keep them massive enough so that at the end of the life they actually make black holes? And so these are competing things that these challenges try to address. And so as I already said, as you also probably know, these things are pretty massive that we've seen at least the first event. 30 solar masses was beyond the... dream of many, except for some people having interesting population synthesis predictions where you just get massive stars out and massive objects. There will be a bias, we can see them to larger distances. So that people have been predicting that we would see massive black holes before they were observed. But for most people, there was a big surprise. This is the inferred masses of various X-ray binaries in our own galaxy. And so most of them are... most of them are 5 to 10 or so, and so there's a few exceptions. They're here, but the error bars are big. So I see 10x1 here, the error bars are between 20 and 60 solar masses, so that might be a candidate. But these are debated. The masses are measured from lines of these stars, and often these are emission lines, and it's very messy. These emission lines have all kind of not all of them are formed at the photosphere. There can be blobs around the star. The star can be variable. So not all these mass measurements, it's just Kepler's law, right? It's just a spectroscopic binary. How hard can it be? Well, it can actually be pretty hard if you don't have absorption lines. So, and so one of the caveats here, we only saw X-ray binaries nearby in our own galaxy and a few galaxies nearby. And so the only populations that we probe is populations that are pretty high in metal content. Comparable to our own, of not too much lower than our own. But the universe was much more interesting than the place where we happen to be living today. So regions where the metal content is lower There would be interesting ways to potentially make things that we don't see nearby, right? Okay, so before we start evolving things, let's look for a moment to the initial conditions. I think they're exciting. A lot happens between birth and coalescing two black holes. But there's a few developments here that if you're not following this field, I think it's exciting to know about. And so we learn from these massive stars and how they're born from observations nearby. This is the Large Magellanic Cloud galaxy nearby. It's very nice because there's not much dust between us and the Magellanic Cloud, and we know at what distance they are. And so here's one where we have one of the largest samples of massive stars of various spectra, and where we have a sample of almost 1,000 massive stars in this region. 1,000, that is a large, that is big data in the field of massive star science, right? There's not many massive stars. We can maybe do this 10 times bigger, but 100 times bigger would be really challenging. We're waiting for ELTs to move to different galaxies, right? And so there's a few interesting things here. So this particular region, I would call it a field, actually, even though it's in the center has a star cluster, but most of the stars are swimming around in this area, and they are not too likely to encounter another star that is doing a lot of damage. But the very center is a dense star cluster, R136, this picture here. And so the latest claims are that, with the words of the press release writers, that there's monster stars in here. And so we took Paul Crowther, got data with the space telescope to look, take spectra of these stars, and so you can take the parameters. So I'm showing here some of the diagrams we use a lot to investigate massive stars, and showing how bright the stars are versus how hot they are. They're hot on this side, and so to guide your eyes, there is a lot of tracks in here, evolutionary tracks. So it will be a 25 Solomas track, 40, 60, 100, and so you'll see a lot of dots or data points up there above the track of 100 Solomas. And we can have a long debate on whether they're really above 100 or not. But there's many of them there, and some of them extending close to 300 Solomas. So the top of the initial mass function that we had been using for a long time to make predictions, it was definitely on the low side. I think typically it was taken at 100. So people are extending these to 500, accounting for some. So this is nearby. Yeah, that's a great discussion. We can have a whole conference on that. Paul Crowther defends this very strongly. They're calibrated on eclipsing spectroscopic binaries that are not as massive. It's a long technical discussion. So I think the short version that holds for now is that there are substantial error bars on there, but there's so many of them that, and the universe is a lot more interesting than just our neighboring galaxy. I think the point for now is that we should be considering this this extension. The question is this the highest mass that single stars are born with, or are these things already mergers, right? So, but that's, okay. Yeah, this is not too low metallicity. It's like half our galaxy. So, drop that by a factor 10, 100, and we can do fun things. So this is a star cluster, and it's also, this is also data that's not out yet, these are full of binaries below there as well. So even the dynamic, if you're doing the dynamic simulations, there's loads of closed binaries in these systems that makes a separation between dynamics and field stars. They're probably unresolved binaries because it's far away. The question is there a companion that is contributing so much to the light that this mass would go down? And that is not so likely. There's room for it. So I can give you the whole list of ways we have tried to find companions, and there is a gap in separation where we're blind to companions. So it is possible, but we don't see radial velocity variations. With the highest spatial resolution that we can get, we don't see anything. For most of them, we don't see X-ray winds, so we can go with the whole list. But yeah. So I should say that these stars have certain spectral features, which we also see in clusters that are in different galaxies. So this is not the only evidence for the extension of the IMF. I should move forward. So it's also full of binary systems. And so one of the things we learned is both that binaries are really common at birth and that they really like to be in close systems from the start. So here I'm showing you the period distribution. I'm thinking of periods. So the binaries I was discussing of 10 solar radii, they're roughly here. And so these will be pretty wide. And so I'm going to show you a cumulative distribution, so it will all go to one. And so the distribution we have been using for a long time in population synthesis, we call it an OPIC law, which is a flat distribution, so it's a straight line here. So there's an equal number of systems in this decade, as this decade, as this decade. And so both results from our group and different groups show that there is a strong preference, that is not just selection effects, there's a strong preference for shorter period systems. So everything, every distribution on this side really loves this short period systems. And that stays there if you account for selection effects. Okay, I'm staying there. So masses, the mass challenge. How do we get these high masses? So one of the first conclusions that could be drawn almost without any extra modeling is these masses are high, and we need to do something to explain them. So I'm here, I'm showing you, this is in the astrophysical implications LIGO paper, this plot, and it's the simulation by Chris Belzinski. And so this is metallicity. So metals, iron. And so we think these metals make a lot of difference how stars evolve, because if in the atmosphere they're so extremely efficient at capturing photons that come out of the star, that it will accelerate the metals, which will drag along other particles, and it will drive a wind of the star. That is, so we think that line-driven wind mass loss is something that is high, high here and low here. So the early universe stars would stay more massive. But we don't really know how much. Yes, Elliot.
I do think it's worth emphasizing that we don't think that line-driven winds are the dominant.
Yeah, yeah, I'm emphasizing this for a big purpose, yeah. Okay, so if you play with this, this is where we have an understanding, but it's still, the understanding is not that well, so Chris took into account uncertainties, I presume. So we have something that he calls a weak wind and a strong wind. And so these are the two massive of the first event. And to catch them at metallicity nearby, the most massive black holes are not making it. If we go to lower metallicity, the weak winds solutions, they hit it. And so as Elliot is setting up, wait, I'm going to move that one step forward. So big uncertainties in the wind for many reasons, already for these line-driven winds. There's a big concern these because of how well the wind is clumped. And then the line-driven winds are only one of the ways stars lose mass. We, of course, put them in a binary, so that's a pretty decent way to be stripped of mass. But we have impulsive episodes of mass loss that we know. We call them LBV eruptions. We see them happening, and we don't fully understand what mechanism is behind it. So this plot is really not doing any justice to... this uncertainty is not the uncertainty here. But we do know we need a low mass loss... to explain these black holes. And so this metallicity effect, at least for the line-driven winds, that is at least something you do know. I'm trying to put a slightly more positive trend now. So from the regions nearby that we can study, which is our own galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is at half solar metallicity, and the Small Magellanic Cloud, which is about one-fifth solar metallicity, from the spectral lines you can measure what these stars are losing in mass. Well, you cannot really directly measure that, but you can measure something called the wind momentum, but it scales with the mass loss rate. And so, if stars are brighter, they will already have more mass loss. So, but you see different trends here. So you see these three fits for these three regions, and you see it's sinking down for the lower metallicity. So this is theoretically predicted, and at least here empirically observed. But only for the first stages of the star's life, not for the later stages where maybe mass loss is dominating. But this is the more positive part of the story where we made progress, I think. So just to show you how big uncertainties are, this is just the uncertainties from wind clumping in line-driven winds, an experiment that Matteo Renzo did with the MESA stellar evolution code. So what he did is he started with a given mass of 15 solar masses here, and I will show different columns of what the final mass is, just varying the algorithms that we have and varying the clumping factor. And so without going into these algorithms, they're semi-empirical or empirical fits. So the crosses... So on this axis, I'm showing you the final mass divided by the initial mass. So no mass loss would be up here. This star has lost 70% of its mass. So this 15 solar mass star, depending on which algorithm you take, you have large variations. And then this is the variations depending on the algorithm, this crosses. And then the bars show you the variations of the clumping that is uncertain. So we don't know whether 15 solar mass star loses 70% of its mass or whether it loses 3% of its mass at the end of its life. That's just single star uncertainties. And we haven't even started talking about all this binary interaction. And I'm not going to scare you more with that, but I think it's good to keep in mind. So for all the masses, you see a lot of variations. And if you go to the 35 solar mass stars, they lose so much that we also have other wind recipes for when they become overhead stars. But
yeah, Mathieu.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, it is... For the red supergiants, we use the empirical fit. So one of them is the Jager, which is also skeleton. Sorry, yes. In the middle. Or ignore clumping. This is, okay, I think this is ignoring clumping. But I'm for a moment, I'm not sure if it is or not this one. Because at this area, it's harder to evolve the stars, and there's so many uncertainties. So, practical reasons. I think it makes the point already. So the real emphasis here is to see what is the impact on the final stages. How compact are the cores? It's a different discussion. Which ones of these are going to make black holes? So, but it's a different discussion. This is a simple version of this. Okay, the separation challenge. And now I'm going to go to the. Does anyone keep track of time for me?
Yeah.
Oh, there. Oh, interesting. Okay. The two main channels. I'll do it pretty briefly, actually. So the classic channel has a solution for the separation challenge. And the classic channel says these stars are not born this way. They're actually born as far apart as you can potentially put them, but they can still interact with each other. I'm simplifying, but and so you put them far apart, and so both stars can basically live their life as single stars for a long time. And they can make a massive central core that wants to become a black hole later. And just before it dies, it becomes so big that it engulfs the other star and brings them together. And then the cores are so massive already that we basically have two black holes. This is the simple version of the story. And we can do that in the many cartoons. So this is the Chris Belczynski's solution for the event. He's starting with pretty massive stars of 100 solar masses and 60 solar masses. So these are simulations. With every respect for Chris, and I do the same simulations, but it's good to know that now we're not doing real stellar evolution, we're doing a sort of synthetic stellar evolution. And if you want to know the dirty deals of that, so there's not even stellar evolution models of this mass behind it, they stop at 50, so it's extrapolation. So anyway, but the general story could hold. So one star is filling its wash lobe. We have separation, so here the separation is 2,000 solar radii, 2,400 at the start. So this star is filling its rush lobe at the last time of its life, and it's giving its mass to the other star. Actually, it's just giving mass to the other one, but it's shrinking at that point. We have the core left of this one, which then is so massive. At this point, it is a 39 solar mass black hole, according to Chris, which probably falls back to a black hole of almost that mass. One black hole formed. Okay, one to go. We have one. Now the second star also is going to expand, and the orbital period is now 3,700 solar radii. And so it will also fill its Roche lobe pretty late. And this time it will go through a common envelope. And so we'll get these stars together. So at this moment we have the core of the secondary next to this black hole. And so that will probably also fold back. It's so massive that it's hard to explode. If that falls back to make a black hole, then Chris has a solution of the right masses at a separation of about 40, and so that merges within a Hubble time, right? Common envelope channel. I'm actually not going to say much more, but there's a good reason I show you this as a cartoon. I think the cartoon level is the level of understanding that we have of this, right? So any of the 3D SPH simulations that try to do the common envelope, we have large trouble ejecting the common envelope. If you look at the simple energy balance, it's pretty hard to match. So we don't have data here yet. I mean, LIGO is going to provide it. But until now, we have been calibrating all this based on double white dwarf systems or the binaries we see in the center of planetary nebula and trying to fiddle with the few parameters that hide all the unknowns about the physics here. But this is the solution to this problem. You start white and come back together later. That's the simple version. And so the second channel that we've been proposing is using something funny. It's starting very close. And we think we potentially have a way for the stars to prevent them to expand. So this is very different. So one channel starts white and they come together later. This channel starts very close. We prevent the stars to expand. So that's the two channels. So we call it chemically homogeneous channels. It has a few other names. We use it called it. So originally, it goes back to something I did with Matteo when we were both PhD students in Utrecht. He was working with Norbert Langer and thinking about rotating stars mostly. And so we had a lot of fun thinking what would happen. So we wrote this at the time we both did our thesis. We were not thinking of a binary black hole, so we were thinking of hoping to make two gamma rays burst out of it. There was enough for the excitement to think about this. But and so the basic idea behind this is that if stars is coming actually from single stars, the physics will be a bit different in binaries, but the idea is that stars that are very deformed, that they're not spherical, for example, deformed because they're rotating, that these stars are a bit flat, and that the equipotential surfaces are no longer spherical, and that you get large-scale circulations. So there's been a long discussion in the literature, and so especially the Geneva group has spent, I should have put more references here, but so we get large-scale circulations. This is the Eddington sweet circulations, which might look something like this, large-scale eddies. And so there's another type of mixing, is that if a star expands or contracts, naturally, all the layers inside the star, they start shearing. And so if there's enough shear, you will have turnover of eddies, and you can transport material from interior outwards and the other way around. And there may be more mixing processes. The takeaway point is that if stars are rotating very fast, they might show these mixing processes. Here I showed the rotation rate of single stars. They go up to high rates. And so we're trying to measure these mixing processes with single stars to see, do we see funny abundance at the surface. But without having full observational proof that this is happening, we can speculate already what happens. And so all this material that is made in the center, stars burn hydrogen into helium in the center, and so normal stars, they expand in response to the contracting core. So the core is becoming helium-rich, contracting, and the envelope expands. That's standard evolution. And so the cartoon picture here is that if you would mix hydrogen and helium very efficiently, helium takes less space than four protons. And that's the intuitive, but also, I think, physically accurate reason. Well, there's a few more things happening in stars, but that's these stars contract. So you slowly convert the entire star from hydrogen into helium. So the cartoon picture, this thing only shrinks. And so this becomes, so this is one of the models we did then, but you can do this, so many people show this, but this is the setup from Sung Chul Yoon. So this is the lifetime of a star, and this is, does it show helium at the surface? This is a star that's not supposed to show helium at the surface. It's showing helium at the surface because it's mixed up. And so this lower line here is non-rotating, no helium at the surface. You rotate faster and faster, and you get more helium at the surface. So much helium that you actually change the stellar structure, and that these stars stay compact. And so we can think about this game. If stars stay compact, they can stay so compact that we can avoid these stars to fill their Roche lobe, or Pablo will show slightly different, subtly different version of this, but that the stars can stay compact and avoid too much mass loss because they fill their Roche lobe. And so that would be the normal channel, but now these stars, they stay inside their Roche lobe. And I'm going to skip this. So the initial models we did here, we really see this. So I'm showing here again how luminous the stars are versus how effective, how the temperatures are, hot versus cool. And so these lines are lines of constant radii. And this is a very massive star, 100 solar masses and metal poor star. This black line is the start of its life if it would be single. And it would expand, and go up here, probably, and be very big for a while, at least. This is a star in a binary system, and you see it's staying, very quickly it's becoming more bright, and it's staying at shorter radii. The 1.7-day binary, that was not enough. It didn't stay compact enough, so we put it in a closer and closer binary, 1.4, 1.2. 1.2, you see it's contracting all the way until the end of the main sequence, but then it swallowed up and expanded, and this one actually did it. This is actually only in the conference proceedings and in discussion of our paper then. We thought it was too speculative to think about at that point. And so it leaves a very hot helium star there. If you do this to both stars, that's very beautiful because we have these both stars in a close orbit that has already the right separation. These stars would shrink, become very massive helium stars. It would be very hard to explode them, so they mostly would fall back, become two massive black holes that are already at roughly the right separations. If you can do, I was going to write a very speculative paper with Ilya Mandel well before the detection, thinking that this would be too speculative to think about, but if anything, you would expect massive black holes to merge in a Hubble time with comparable masses and high masses. So we were not really accelerating enough to make it before the announcement, but so this is the original simulations we did, but There's different groups. So Song et al., there's a Geneva group, also showed this, but they were not talking about gravitational wave detections at this point. We're just exploring the channel. And Pablo has followed up on this, and he will tell you in much more detail what exciting things you can get out. And I could show you what the masses and et cetera that are coming from this. I think I'll just leave with this. So this is the predictions from the simple estimate we made from our channel, folding it with the LIGO detection sensitivities. I think this is for the first observing run. So this would be the total redshifted mass and the mass ratio. And in the background, you see the distribution from our simulations where we would predicted events to occur. And this is the first event. So one of the things to point out, this would probably only make massive events, and in our case, relatively equal mass, much more equal mass in Pablo's event. But so if this channel is working, it would make a distinct population. And I'll leave it at, okay, just to end with this. So is this really happening? We're trying to find proof for this from all the other things that this channel predicts, right? If one of these systems make a final black hole, there will be a lot of things on the way that don't make it to make double black holes, but they would have observable consequences that we might see in our own universe, right? And so one of them is that we would have near contact binaries that are a bit too hot for their own good. And so one of them is actually, this is an artist impression of a binary system that we found in the field that I just showed you before by Leonardo Almeida. It's the most massive over contact hottest binary system. It's 30 and 30 solar masses today. It's probably going to lose mass. This is not necessarily a progenitor, but things like this could be progenitors. And so from here, I will just leave you with your summary. For the field populations, choose your favorite cartoon. This would be the common envelope channel from Chris Belczynski's paper. This would be the shrinking, the homogeneously evolution and shrinking channel that we're thinking about. Thanks.
So Selma, I have a question. Is there any way, I know it goes through a lot of uncertain supernova physics, but you say with the chemically homogeneous channel, you have very rapidly spinning stars. Can you make any predictions for the distributions of the spins of the final black holes, the angular momentum, they're going to be?
So we're having this discussion over and over, and there's more, and is Juna here? No, she's not. I mean, people are putting papers out. Maybe the spin will tell you directly what is the difference between the two. And so there's two areas where people are extremely cautious. One is, the constraints on the spin are pretty weak at the moment. And the second is, yes, we can predict what the spin here is with pretty uncertainty. It's still stellar evolution. But I will put some money on predictions for the spin here. I'm not putting money on this transition for the spin. What happens during the collapse? So that will be a question that we have a few experts in the room, and they will come later, that can discuss, is the spin conserved, or can you change the spin substantially? But on average, we would expect more aligned spins from this channel than the dynamic channel. And on average, I would expect higher spins here than here. But that's very qualitative. Yeah.
I was planning to push on this quite a bit in the afternoon. The very detailed predictions, sure, which are very inconsistent, I would say, with the data. So
I think if there weren't any data, you would have probably predicted spins in one.
Yeah, well, the Marshall does probably.
Okay. So I don't think the word predict is here, because even though we did some of these simulations before, the time these papers came out, these papers came out before, no, this particular one not. But this is, by now it's post-dictions, right? We thought of this channel, but...
If you're doing theory, you should get the same answer.
Yeah. You're an estimating psychology of the field, Lars.
Doing honest theory, it shouldn't matter.
I do some spin predictions from this, which is, well, just as Selma said, it's just taking the spin of the helium star and assuming direct collapse and complete conservation. But I think the one important thing is to see whether or not we would have kicks in this, and I guess that's something the data will tell us in the end. Maybe not LIGO, because it would be hard to confuse that with what Carl will be talking afterwards. Because we can have strongly misaligned spins due to dynamical formation or due to kicks at the moment of black hole formation. And I guess the important thing about kicks is that kicks are a killer for the common envelope channel, because you have these extremely wide binaries, and if you have kicks in the formation of the first black hole, then it's very hard to remain with a bound orbit. But yeah, I guess it's hard to get proper predictions without doing extreme oversimplifications.
The kicks will kill you here, but here you're in such a tight binary that the kicks will not kill you. They might not even do much because at this point the orbital velocities are around 500 kilometers a second or more, to 800 kilometers a second for these masses. So if kicks are not comparable to the orbital velocity, they wouldn't have that much effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, some simple estimates we did, we saw that it might even go the other way or leave it quite so. I mean, you get the kicks favoring putting the things in very compact eccentric orbits as well when you're very compact.
Around this this lower cutoff you have on the black hole mass that you predict for when you fold it through the LIGO
here,
model, what is causing? Is that just because the mixing is more efficient for the massive stars? And
okay, so
how sensitive is that to the?
If I would freely play with the mixing efficiency, I could mix probably 10 solar mass stars, and we could move this downward. So if you want to allow for all those uncertainties. We would need to make sure that the 10 solar mass stars we see in our own galaxy are still matching the models, right? We cannot play the physics game differently for... We have to do this concordance fitting of these physical processes. But so the reason is that at lower mass stars are less dominated by radiation pressure, more by gas pressure, and so they're inherently more stable. So natural prediction is that the rotational mixing or any mixing process become less efficient if you drop in mass.
So I'd like to come into a little bit of the defense of the left-hand side picture and say that, you know, if you have high kicks, then you are likely to have a distribution of kicks. And of course, the cases with high kicks will get disrupted, but you will still get a number of systems where you had low kicks, and then they will survive all the way up to formation of a binary black hole.
Yeah, so the pain and all these things are still rare, meaning we can come up with rare and strange things, meaning it can be the exception, right?
In the case of your fast rotators, shouldn't they be always tidally locked? Your picture suggested this. So this means for every separation, you have only one rotation velocity?
Over their main sequence evolution, they are tidally locked when they're still big. When they shrink, if you take the simple Zahn time scales, they would be about tidally locked. But there's a lot of prefactors in front of these timescales that are uncertain. So one of the uncertainties is, are they decoupling tidally from their companion at that point or not? But on the main sequence, they're fully locked. Or they might even, in the variation that Pablo is looking at, they're actually in contact, so they're actually forming one system. Yeah.
So can you comment on the evidence for anomalous chemical compositions correlated with particularly rapid rotation? How well constrained is this observationally, et cetera?
Okay, the lines of evidence, this is mixed a bit with the historical census in the field where people have been using rotation to explain everything that later normal binary interaction can do. So the evidence, lines of evidence you see are sometimes a bit not fully clear. So the things I think is full evidence, we think we see rotating stars that have enhanced surface abundances that are not supposed to be there. That might be because it's mixed, but it's not foolproof because rotating stars may also have had a binary companion that they played with. But it's in the community seen as one of the
enhancement of what exactly?
Nitrogen, helium. So there are more elements that you would predict, but the observers cannot measure all, right? So they need to have lines in the spectra of a telescope that you can surface abundances. this particular binary that I showed you, this contact binary, the stars are too hot for their mass and for the evolutionary state. And so there's not many ways out to make stars too hot. One of the easy ways out is to have a bit more mixing of helium throughout the star. It's actually one of... it's a pretty weak case, but it's probably one of the strongest cases we have. Then there's a particular binary, and I think Pablo will mention it as well, is that it's a binary that probably started like this, but later winds widened it. It is in the SMC, and the parameters really nicely fit with the chemically homogeneous predictions from Pablo, second system I'm talking about. Then there's two or three single stars that are rotating and too hot for their own good, but within error bars they could be somewhere else. Okay, that's from resolved stellar populations. Then there is, not, hints from unresolved stellar populations. So this has been proposed to be the cause of strong helium 46, 86, and other lines that we see in redshift 2 galaxies, where potentially these stars are contributing. And the only models today that can do that is either models from John Eldridge, including this homogeneous evolution, or you have to invoke things like POP3 stars. So whichever you feel more comfortable with. I think that's very likely. So when we thought about this, we actually thought this would be a gamma ray burst event at the moment that it would make this one, which is not, there's no expectation of that here. It's not clear what, I mean, you can lose some of the angular momentum here, so it's not necessarily a gamma ray burst event. But
Someone, can you say a little bit about pre-main sequence?
Oh, yeah.
Pre-main sequence issues like Elliot raised earlier. How do you make the close ones?
I skip over that phase. Because observations of populations that are 1 or 2 million years old tell us there are binaries. And so that's the moment we have a measurement where I start measuring it. And so it's an extremely interesting question. We should discuss this later when we have a longer workshop in. So one of the chances, so people discuss, can you form two binaries and have a binary, have a disk around it that can drag it in? Or can you go through some sort of common envelope like phase dragging them in? Can third stars drive them together? Can star, the, one of the oldest ideas was was if a star is super fast spinning, maybe it can split at the last moment. That people have put that idea aside. Well, a part it's suddenly raised again to split black holes, but let's not discuss that.
Just a quick question following what Pablo said. So you said when you can get, if you can get kicks, you can get high eccentricities in the binaries. How eccentric and how close to merger? I mean, is the, could there be residual eccentricity in this formation channel that's detectable, or is it all Peters and Matthews radiated away really quickly? That
you say it's
eccentric, but it's not an eccentric one. So far as I remember, when you get to the LIGO band, it's essentially nothing. But there were two papers recently that said ELISA should be able to see plenty of eccentricity in there. So it would be, ELISA would be very good to discern between formation scenarios.
Well, there's a close to zero chance, but if this, the second black hole will be formed and has an eccentricity right for this one, that will be a super minority channel. But so there are extreme minority cases where it could happen, but I think we can ignore them for probability reasons.
So I'm just going to, so almost everything you talked about was about the 30 solar mass binary. What about the other two? Do you want to make those by the traditional method?
So this, at the moment, unless we really boost the mixing, then this channel will not make the lower mass ones. We could boost the mixing. There's complete freedom there. So if you want them to make them from the field, it has to be in this regime or variations on these things, right? So yeah.
What is boost the mixing?
Boost the mixing, meaning...
What is your free parameter?
It's scaling both. So yeah. So you know this, but you're asking me. FC. So it is the so mixing is implemented in 1D codes as a diffusion process. At least in MESA, there's variations here. The diffusion coefficients are combined, and there's one factor in front of them that we move up or down. And we try to calibrate this against surface abundances that are observed, but there's lots of issues we can talk about that are there. There's theoretical considerations for the value of that parameter, which is not too far off. And if you take those values, that is where our predictions come from, or at least the Pablo's, actually.
Okay, so let's thank Selma again. So we now have a talk by Carl Rodriguez from Northwestern University. And I remind you there will be a follow-up discussion this afternoon with, which will be led by